When I asked for your advice, I didn't mean you should actually speak. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that still wants to know who's banging Alena Ryzhkov. Now, as a kid growing up in the 1980s, there were only two things I feared: the disapproval of my mother and imminent nuclear destruction. Yes, this was the era of the Cold War, when we all lived only minutes from instant Armageddon. All that was supposed to end with the fall of the Soviet Union, but in the following years, we learned all that had happened was that the nuclear threat had become an awful lot more complicated. Whether it was rogue states, rogue generals, or rogue terrorists, the dangers of disappearing into an atomic mushroom cloud had simply multiplied. All this was the political backdrop for the film we're reviewing on this show, 2002's The Sum of All Fears, where the plot sees some dastardly terrorists try to trick America and Russia into a full-scale nuclear war. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who loves nothing better than to feel the warm glow of plutonium decay. It's Tim Westmeyer of the Supercritical Podcast. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you very much. Yeah, excited to be here. Long time listener, long time also, general nightmare haver of nuclear war. So, and I don't know, I think probably is because I watch a lot of movies about nuclear war right before bed. I'm sure that's what it is, but I can't seem to break the habit. Really excited to be here, and also kindred spirit of getting really into a niche topic and just seeing how far we can go with it. I'm glad people enjoy listening to yours, because this is a great community of people that we've got here. Excited to be here.
Well, I'm grateful to have you here, and very excited to have you here, because you're sort of an expert in some of the things that we're going to be talking about today, which is something of a blessed relief with the general caliber of guest I have on this show. I wondered fill our sort of listeners in who might not be familiar with the podcast that you do. Could you sort of take a moment to tell us about your sort of day job and what you do at the Supercritical Podcast?
Sure, absolutely. So I have I study nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy for quite a while now. Since like 2005 is when I've been in this field. And it started as something that I thought was interesting in high school. I was a high school debater and enjoyed these topics. And it happened to be the years I was debating. These were weapons of mass destruction topics, so they really got me hooked on the issues. Then at the same time, I'll mention the movie we're about to talk about, I saw on a debate trip when I was in high school, so completely enamored with it. And, ever since then, have worked in various places, either at think tanks where we talk about these issues and kind of come up with ideas of what to do next to reduce the danger of nuclear weapons, or I've worked at various places in government, at the State Department for a little while, trying to help secure loose nuclear material around the world and making sure that it would be something that would be accomplished. That was the Nuclear Security Summit that the President Obama worked on for quite a while. And these days, I work at a company called CRDF Global. And interesting enough, it was founded after the Soviet Union collapsed. And there were all these weapon scientists, like we see in the movie, who still want to be able to feed their families and, pay rent, but no longer have paychecks because the government doesn't exist. And what we, were founded to do was to help find civilian opportunities for them so that they didn't get, drawn into working for Libya or North Korea or some, nefarious shadow neo-Nazi Austrian group. Any of those things. We were founded to help provide those opportunities. And nowadays, we do a bunch of other really interesting things. And what I mostly work on these days is helping to, reduce the danger that North Korea poses in terms of its nuclear weapons program. So all of these things kind of combine together to make it me also insufferable while watching movies where there's nuclear plots. I'm sure as you are when you see a helicopter, fly upside down and don't understand why that's doing that. I have, ever since I saw this movie in 2002, have kind of been someone who likes to go, oh, actually, that's not how it is, and then am not very much fun while in movies. But I do enjoy the podcast that I do, Supercritical Podcast. We look at movies with nuclear weapon topics. It started as a therapy for me to rant and rave about things that get right or be things that get wrong or be surprised when things are right. And now it's really just an entertaining mission of why certain topics that are very important and change over time, have people's perceptions of nuclear war. And a lot of it is reflecting art, reflecting life, but also life reflecting art in many super interesting ways, which I have a few examples of that when we get into the plot here, particularly things like the red phone and kind of some of the other topics that we'll cover here. But that's what I do. So the Supercritical Podcast been around for since 2016. I do one episode a month, and we've done a couple classics, and people will definitely see a couple of helicopters being exploded in those movies as well.
Yeah, well, it's a podcast that I really enjoy listening to. So, yeah, keep up the good work. It hits a real sort of sweet spot for me. I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in history, and obviously I'm interested in movies. And you hit a sweet spot of intersection between all of those of interest for me. But I watch a lot of Exploding Helicopters in terms of the podcast and website that I do, and there's many tropes that that I see turn up time and time again that I really can't stand. And I was interested in asking you, what is the most egregious nuclear movie cliche, the one that really makes you grind your teeth together?
I've got a really, when I answer this question, I always try to jump back and forth between these two, but I'm going to just give you it is a tie between the idea that when you fire a nuclear missile, that you can push a button and it detonates and it, you know, aborts the mission. That doesn't exist, because if it did exist, they thought about it, but then they came to the conclusion, if this did exist, our enemies would find a way to do the same thing and shut off our weapons and have them explode. So the important thing about that is, you know, when the U.S. president makes a decision to push, I'll talk about the next thing and to push a button. When the president makes a decision to launch a nuclear weapon and there's a missile and it's in the air, that's it. And there's not much time that they have to actually make that decision. It's about 4 minutes for them to make the total decision of once they're given the options. So it's a very short amount of time because of the way that we have decided to set up our nuclear weapons. And once you push that, metaphorical button and start the process, it can't really be stopped, even when the missiles are in the air. So we better be careful about all the things before that. And the other is the nuclear button, which we get into, I think, in the detail here. It's not a button. There is no red button. It's not a briefcase with a button, all this kind of stuff. But it is, you could argue, you know, it's it operates like a button because of how machine-like some of the process forces human beings to think about these things that really ultimately result in the death of millions of people and possibly the whole world. But that's, we'll get into that. Those are the two that really grind my helicopter gears the most.
Yeah. Well, such a comforting thought to know that once nuclear missiles have been launched, that's it. It's game over for everyone. But let's get stuck into the sum of all fear. So let's see if Trailer Man can tell us what time it is.
At a time of increasing tension.
According to this, there are 17 senior scientists on duty today.
I only count 14.
Deliberate deception.
Three Russian scientists are missing. I need to know where they are.
Shut up. I don't go on the missions. I just write reports.
So write a report about it.
I'm an analyst.
I'm not trained for this.
Just be my eyes and ears.
I can't be with somebody who's going to keep their life hidden from me, Jack.
I will not let that happen.
And new enemies.
You don't fight Russia and America. You get Russia and America to fight each other and destroy each other.
Only two men suspect the truth.
What's a South African doing in the Ukraine? With three Russian scientists in a crate from Israel.
Fair guess, they're building a bomb.
When the president of Russia suddenly dies, he's replaced by a man unknown to the world at large and whose grip on power is far from certain. Amidst the heightened tensions between East and West, an Austrian neo-Nazi plans to trigger a nuclear war between the United States and Russia so that he can establish a fascist superstate in Europe. After scientists hired by the neo-Nazis build a secret nuclear weapon that destroys Baltimore, the world's superpowers are pushed close to the brink of war. The only person who can stop it is CIA analyst Jack Ryan. Can he find the evidence to prove the true source of the deadly bomb? And can he stop the impending nuclear conflict? Now, this film is based on a book by the best-selling techno-thriller writer Tom Clancy. It's one of a series of novels featuring the character Jack Ryan. Obviously, we've now seen a film series based on those books and characters. This is the fourth of five films that have been made to date. There's also been a Jack Ryan TV series and a recent sidequel movie called Without Remorse with a character called John Clark, who we meet in this film. Back to The Sum of All Fears. This was directed by Phil Alden Robinson, who's best known for writing and directing Field of Dreams and Sneakers. The cast here is headed up by Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman, but there's a very deep bench of actors here, including Liev Schreiber, James Cromwell, Philip Baker Hall, Alan Bates, Kieran Hines. I'm just going to leave it there. There's tons of talent in this film, wherever you look. The movie has a 6.4 rating on IMDb and a 2.8 out of 5 rating on Letterboxd. So with all of that out of the way, Tim, what did you make of The Sum of All Fears?
Every time I rewatch this movie, I learn to appreciate it a bit more. I think when I saw it in 2002, I actually think I enjoyed it, but it was, I didn't have a really refined palette back then. I think it took me, I didn't see this movie for then quite a while, but when I rewatched it for the podcast, the Supercritical podcast, I think it was 2019, I enjoyed it. There are a lot of things that, like, little plot holes here and there that you can really, you know, pull out if you want to, but I really thought it worked well. My wife, who's not a big action movie person and probably not even further away from being a Ben Affleck fan, really enjoyed it as well. I think it's got a lot of, the action sequences are fun. I think maybe near the end there's a tiny bit of a lull, but it picks up pretty quickly at the end there, and particularly for me as someone who, if you flub the nuclear stuff, you can still get away if the movie's entertaining. Like, I love Mission Impossible, Fallout, and Shadow, whatever that was, Ghost Protocol, thank you. I really enjoy those movies, but the nuke stuff in there is completely nonsense. This movie does a nice combination of, like, the stuff that they show. It's not all perfect, but it's pretty good. And I weirdly appreciate the effort into that. So for me, from that perspective, I really enjoyed it. And I thought we'll get into the, maybe at the very end when we talk about our Jack Ryan universe here. And I don't think Ben Affleck was all that bad in this. I think he pulls off a young, fresh faced Russian expert analyst and does a pretty good job of all of that. And overall, I would enjoy this movie. I certainly would recommend it to people that are interested in seeing helicopters up, you know, damaged in a variety of different ways, nuclear or otherwise.
Yeah. I think I'm in a similar boat to yourself, because I really like this film, and I had seen it many moons ago, and it didn't make much of an impression on me, but rewatching it for this particular podcast, it's really sort of gone up in my estimation. I think it's a cracking thriller. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and argue that it's a classic or a masterpiece, but I mean, it's a really, I think, high quality film that is quite actually intelligent and works quite hard to create a sort of convincing realism within which the sort of film takes place. Because in many ways, the plot here is quite like a Bond movie. You've got, you know, some neo-Nazi trying to trick the world's superpowers into a nuclear conflict. I mean, that could have been, you know, something out of 1970s Roger Moore starring sort of James Bond. But here actually that scenario plays out, but in a way which feels quite realistic. And I actually enjoyed the fact that, you know, this isn't a pure action film. I mean, there are moments of action in it, but largely it's more sort of like detective work or you know, as the character would suggest, sort of, you know, analysis work. And I kind of enjoyed the fact that, it's not all sort of diving off the top of skyscrapers and, you know, sort of hurtling about in massive motorbikes, you know, firing guns at other people on motorbikes, you know, a la Mission Impossible 2 or something.
Yeah, I think they pick and choose their spots pretty well when they want to focus in on the action. I think that it's so fascinating. When you talked about the timing of this movie, you know, it was based on a book who was very much focused on the more traditional 1980s book, but it seems definitely like it would be. I think I read it probably like in high school, but I remember it definitely had much more of the terrorists there were Islamic terrorists who wanted to disrupt a peace process that Jack Ryan was involved in negotiating. Jack Ryan in the book is much more of a senior official. You think it's even at the top of the CIA, supposed to be in the kind of the fresh-faced folk here. But then this took place, the movie was released right after, you know, 9/11 in the United States, and they decided it was too soon to have that as a plot. So they kind of went back to the more traditional Cold War stuff that some movies love to. There's so many movies where there was a plot point of, let's start a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, and it'll either cleanse the universe, cleanse the world, and we'll start new, or I'll be able to rise from the ashes and all of this stuff. Mission Impossible does that twice. I think both Fallout and Ghost Protocol have the exact same endpoint plot anyways, but it's weird that it's a very interesting trope there, but I think the movie does a good job of kind of when it decides to focus on certain things, and it works out pretty well. I think weirdly enough, and I'll just put one more thing here, I think it works a little bit better than that Without Remorse show you mentioned and on Amazon, which I enjoyed watching from point A to point Z, but it just felt like a movie that really was meant to be released during the early 90s or the 80s It was a movie that was, they didn't really change like the central Russia-US tension, which certainly exists today, but not, like, it felt like a movie that should have been back then. The, Some of All Fears tries to still draw on that stuff because it didn't go away or anything. The 90s, you know, still, it is, despite the kind of between the wars period here, between the Afghanistan war and the Gulf War, it still had a bit of a Cold War feel to it. And it did an okay job with that, and I enjoyed that a lot. And there's a lot of really interesting things about U.S.-Russia escalatory conflict and the nuclear points and things that really kept me entertained through it. So I like it. I'm glad that I get another chance to revisit it.
Well, you touched on it just now, and yeah, I think that's an element of the film that I really liked was that the film generates its dramatic tension by the escalating conflict between America and Russia, and we can see, you know, both sides making dangerous assumptions about each other and trying to make huge decisions with less than perfect information. And for me, that's where a lot of the tension and the enjoyment and that sort of sense of realism came from. And, you know, I wondered, you know, how that aspect of the film worked for you.
So much of planning for nuclear deterrence, which is the idea that you can deter someone from using a nuclear war, deter someone from using a nuclear weapon or starting a nuclear war with you by the fact that you have them. And there's this idea of mutually assured destruction. If you start something, I will always have the ability. I've designed my systems in place, and I've given me the time that I need to also launch so that you have no ability to decapitate me from destroying you as well. I always will have what they call a survivable second strike, whether that's from a submarine or in the United States, putting all of their nuclear weapons in the middle of the heartland so that it takes a little bit longer for the missiles or bombers to get there. There's all these different things you do to set up your plans, that there's this idea still at the central of all of this planning that you have either perfect information or you are able to assess what's going on. And really, particularly with Russia, we often don't know what their plans are. We didn't know a lot of what their plans were in the Cold War. We made a lot of worst-case assumptions about the number of missiles and bombers that they had and what they would do with them. And when the Soviet Union collapsed and we were able to actually start to talk to some of these scientists and some of these military planners and the politicians, we learned that we really didn't know a lot about what they were up to. And we also discovered a number of really interesting things, like from Dr. Strangelove, the movie of the Doomsday Machine. Russia had a version of this, and it was called Perimeter, and it was they never knew whether or not it was actually activated, but they had it ready to go. It wouldn't be as devastating as it was in the movie, but it would be basically a dead hand trigger that would detect nuclear detonations on their soil and then respond in kind. So, like, there are all these really fascinating things, and you're always working off of imperfect information. And so much of what the United States and Russia, but particularly U.S. war planners, are trying to do is encourage things like arms control. Because arms control, one of the main things when you try to negotiate these treaties, like they do at the end of this movie, spoiler alert, and negotiate a new agreement, is that it provides a little bit more information about what the other side's doing. And if you have good arms control verification procedures, you know, trust but verify, then you can actually not do worst case scenario planning. You have a bit more information about how many weapons they have, where are they located. Some of these things are, if you want to open up your internet and Google, you know, where is the U.S., you know, missile silos located, it's public information because they want the other side to know where they are so that they can target them. And they also know that they have, you know, 400 instead of 1,000, because if they had 1,000, the other side would need to have 1,000. All of these things are things that people struggle with, is getting good information, good transparency. And when it doesn't happen, when there's tension, when there's conflict, when there's subterfuge, things that would happen today in the form of cyber attacks and misinformation and Twitter, absolutely there would be a lot of confusion about what was going on. And the movie does a great job of just trying to show, like, the decision makers don't have the information, they're working off the wrong assumptions, there are people like Jack Ryan that are trying to get that information into the right hands. You know, of course, would it always work like that? You know, probably it'll be a bit more, probably more meetings and bureaucratic meetings and things, but I think they do a great job of showing that that's a really important part of escalation, both up the ladder and down the ladder.
Well, there is, you know, we've been quite sort of complimentary about this movie so far, but there is one, I think, obvious weakness in this film, which for me, it's the villain and quite what their motivation is. So we have this Austrian neo-Nazi played by Alan Bates, and it seems that he is heading up this global conglomeration of fascists or neo-fascists. And There's a couple of moments in the film that where Alan Bates gets to sort of expound what his, well, manifesto or what his rationale is, but none of them were terribly convincing. I he seems to be sort of complaining that Europe is getting squeezed in the middle between Russia and America, but quite, you know, the detail is not, you know, what does he actually mean by that is never really described. And I don't quite know, yeah, what he was hoping to achieve in this film. I don't know how did he and his motivations strike you?
I mean, as we get introduced to him, because he's kind of, he's in Vienna and he's delivering what looks like a TED talk. And it's about, he says, I think the well over 50 years of Russia and the U.S. imposing their will on the Europeans. He talks about the loss of sovereignty. He wants the ability for Europe to chart its own course, its own destiny. So does that sound familiar? I mean, it kind of does these days. You know, there are certainly many movements in Russia, many movements in Europe and in the United States of people wanting sovereignty. You know, I would imagine like Brexit, you could make a case it's along those lines, or just, you know, there are these movements that want, you know, fewer immigrants. They want fewer. I guess that's the one thing he doesn't seem to argue for. But maybe that's step two or three after the nuclear war. But it is weird because people, there are movies about, you know, he should have seen, like Threads and others, about what happens if there's a nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia. It's not going to only be between the U.S. and Russia. Europe's going to get involved. You know, there are nuclear weapons in the United Kingdom. There are nuclear weapons in Turkey, in Germany, in France.
Well, a lot of European countries are members of NATO, and they would be systematically brought into such a conflict.
So it wouldn't, you know, there's this guy, he probably is also a climate change denier, so he probably denies the existence of nuclear winter, all this kind of stuff. So all he has to do is watch any of the movies that I watch on a regular basis and realize that, could you have a limited nuclear exchange from two countries? Yeah, if they're not like the United States and China or Russia. But even a small, even a medium-sized nuclear war between India and Pakistan, there are a number of studies that focus on nuclear winter and what the amount of soil and radioactive soil that would be brought up into the air would cause global temperatures to drop just enough to cause pretty major devastation across the world. So to think that this would not affect this individual, but maybe, I don't think this person is necessarily meant to be sane. It's kind of like when people complain about Thanos in the Marvel Universe. Like, yeah, his plan of 50% eliminating people doesn't make any sense. Like, well, yeah, he's insane. You know, it's like it's a little bit crazy here. I think this is certainly but from a exciting plot perspective, it's very clear that they're trying to shoehorn something in a little bit. At least you can make the case that in the book, their aims were very limited. It was trying to disrupt a peace operation. And it was also people, I think it was like Palestinian terrorists who were trying to disrupt a peace plan by blaming Iran for a nuclear attack. So at least you can maybe make a case that could be something that's a little bit less intense on a global scale than U.S.-Russia, you know, nuclear war. But it certainly raises the stakes.
Well, let's talk about some of the nuclear issues in particular. And I should kick this off by pointing people towards the excellent episode that you did about this film over at the Supercritical podcast. You guys really did the deep dive on there. But there were certain elements that I wanted to talk about, and I thought it would be interesting for my listeners over an Exploding Helicopter to kind of get your expertise on. And first, you know, I wanted to ask you about the villains, and specifically whether they could have built this bomb. So they have got hold of this old salvaged Israeli nuclear missile that's been sort of dug up from the ground. It was like lost in the 1970s. It's been sort of recovered, and that's where they've got this nuclear material from. They've got hold of three Russian scientists and a rather decrepit looking warehouse in the Ukraine. So, you know, with the kind of resources that the villains had here, could they have put together the sort of device that we see in this film?
So in terms of the question you asked, you know, it's always been assumed that the hardest part about building a nuclear bomb is access to the fissile material. And fortunately, it's really difficult to get that. You know, you can dig up yourself, if you want to, some uranium from the ground, but it will be in the kind of isotope that you need to generate the supercritical reaction that you want. is fairly rare. It's like, you know, less than 1%, less than like 0.5%, less than 0.25% of what you'll find if you find a whole block of it. So what they have to do is they have to enrich it through a variety of different means and remove the stuff they don't want. They're left with a little bit. You do that a bunch over and over and over again, and you can get an enrichment level of, you know, 70 to 90%, which is usually considered to be the kind of stuff you would use to build a nuclear weapon. That's really hard and usually is a pretty significant engineering task. And also, if people could figure it out, it's likely going to be noted by someone because of how much energy and space it involves. Even plutonium is even harder because you need usually to burn that uranium in a plutonium producing reactor. Plutonium gets produced after you burn uranium in a normal power reactor, but there are special ways you can make more of it. All that's really difficult. So, but if you get access to that and you get the enrichment work, then a lot of the stuff you need to do next, or some of it's not all that complicated today, but normally in what you would, when you would talk about, well, if you had access to the material, someone could build a bomb, they often refer to like a crude nuclear bomb where you have uranium, you can shape your enriched uranium to these shapes that you need, and you develop this thing called a gun barrel, gun design, where you take two pieces of uranium, you actually explode one of them down the tube so that it smacks into the other one, and it gets really compressed. And when it's really compressed, there's a lot less space for, you know, the neutrons that you're trying to bang off of other elements of uranium. They have a lot less places to go. It's a lot of empty space when it's not compressed together. That design is fairly simple. People can do it. I mean, if you find a lot of these things online about terrorists that had access to bomb designs, it's usually the gun type. It's the kind that the United States never tested before it was used against Hiroshima. The United States never tested it until later on. The South Africans never tested their version of a gun barrel gun type design. It's pretty basic science. It's still hard, but it's fairly simple. The movie, though, I'm pretty sure is a plutonium bomb. Plutonium is much more complicated. Plutonium, because of some unique things about it, it would fizzle out if you tried to use the gun barrel design. So you have to do something where you take the plutonium, you put it into a sphere, which is really difficult to do, but you know, you could do it. Then you have these very complicated precision high explosive design. It kind of looks like a soccer ball or a football in terms of the shapes of the charges if you were to look at it externally, but it has to all explode at the exact same time to compress it from the size of, say, like a grapefruit to the size of a golf ball. That is really hard. That is some of those things that you have to know how to do that. That's very difficult. That plus a lot of other things that are involved are usually the things that would prevent most people never talk about a terrorist organization building a plutonium bomb because it's really difficult. That's the premise I'll start with here about how hard it is to do that. The movie says, well, we've got these three scientists who all have different roles. Some of them are explosive experts. Some of them are chemistry and physics. Other of them are, you know, plutonium, you know, handlers. So I'm at least really happy the movie decided that it wasn't just one mad scientist that they got, you know, one person whose daughter was kidnapped and they're trying to hold them hostage. At least I'm glad that they separated that out, because a lot of the ideas of how you build a nuclear weapon, you know, this stuff is specialized because it's hard to do any one thing. Like Robert Oppenheimer couldn't do all of these things. He was a designer and theoretical physicist, but they had to bring in people who were specialized during the Manhattan Project who knew how to build lenses, these explosive lenses. You know, these are the lot of different things you had to do here. I'm at least glad that it was separated out. It's also compartmentalized on purpose because they don't want one person to be able to do that. So one person is never given the whole pieces of the puzzle. Weapon designers know how to build it, but they don't know how to build individual pieces. Yeah, I think at least I'm willing to suspend enough disbelief that these three people have enough to take some plutonium that was already in a bomb and remove it, clean it up. And really the key thing I think they did, it looks like they rebuilt the explosive lens of the movie. Detail is not bad in the film. I really appreciate that. When John Clark is kind of, actually, I guess John Clark had gotten there when they were already dead, but we see a scene of them, you know, building this together. I thought it looked pretty good. I mean, it was pretty silly about how the decrepit place in Ukraine that they have there. But honestly, plutonium is not that dangerous to handle, even when it's enriched in weapons grade. There's a scene in the movie where they find the person who originally dug up the Israeli bomb, and that person's dying from radiation sickness. Uranium, you can hold in your hand. It's warm. But as long as it doesn't get broken into small pieces and you ingest it, that's when it's really bad, because it only emits these things called alpha particles, which your skin blocks. gamma radiation is the nasty stuff. So if it was already undergoing fission and producing gamma radiation, that would be what you're concerned about. But when it's in this what they call less than critical configuration, which is what you keep it because you don't want your bomb exploding when you drop it, it's not that radioactive. It's warm because it's producing heat. But anyways, the movie tries to put that onto it. But I don't know. I would say overall, you know, the place that they go to, the movie, Jack Ryan and the CIA director, is this place called Arzamas 16. It's a real location. It was where the Russians built their atomic bomb. It was where their hydrogen bomb was designed, which is what you would use plutonium for. So these people there, they were there decommissioning bombs. These people generally, if you could take apart a bomb, you generally know how to build one. Overall, I would say if I had to put a score to it, it's definitely like a 7 out of 10 of the feasibility scale, which is scores better than any other movie that I've seen in terms of, most of the time it's one random guy who knows everything, like it was in Ghost Protocol. Someone who was not only a physicist, a radical, he also he was a game theorist. He knew everything and he can do everything. That's often not how it goes.
Now, a significant plot point revolves around establishing where the plutonium came from. So this is in order for, you know, Jack Ryan to try and prove, as he believes, that the Russians weren't involved in this particular sort of nuclear explosion. So, you know, in this film, we see some, a military team of nuclear experts, testing material from the bomb that they've recovered from the site. And they're able to determine that it came, you know, where it actually came from. It came from a particular nuclear plant, even to the reactor that it came from, a bit like they're sort of reading a serial number. Now, I already know the answer to this, but, you know, I'm sure that when I first saw this film, I thought that seemed, you know, probably incredibly fanciful. But, can you actually do that? Or did they take some dramatic license here?
You absolutely can if you have the right source of material where it came from, if you have the isotope library, which is what they would have had in this movie from Savannah River. They would have known, it would have had the signals that every reactor that burns uranium produces plutonium, or any ways that when you develop this fissile material, always has this weird little signature, something that's a little bit off. The movie, I think they called it they always had that gadolinium problem, which is kind of a nonsense thing. it's pretty silly, but there are these things that are there. The big problem is that it takes a lot longer than it does in the movie. It usually takes upwards of 90 days, so 20 to 90 days for them to go through this process. I mean, maybe they had just the right crack shot team that figured out some sort of system, but most of the time we can do nuclear forensics, but it's likely not going to be actionable information that you can work off of. But what will improve it is a lot of initiatives that people have taken, in the non-proliferation community to build up as much of a library of these radioactive isotope sources as possible, and trying to get countries like Russia and Pakistan and others on board with that is sometimes difficult, because really quickly Pakistan, what the thing that we're worried with them is that a weapon gets stolen and gets given to someone for use, and it's not actually the Pakistani's military or the Pakistani government's intention to give a nuclear weapon to someone. But if they give up the radioactive sources and it gets stolen nevertheless, they might feel like they're responsible for it. So they'd rather you not know where it came from than they'd be able to have a return address. But that's effort that people are making some pretty good work on. And the more samples you have of both the detonation as well as the source of where it might have come from, it makes it a lot easier. It's just a lot longer of a timeline.
Well, the last sort of nuclear question I wanted to pose to you was around the mechanics or the processes of, you know, how America is gearing itself up to potentially launch its, nuclear missiles. You know, how well was that side of the film portrayed?
I think it was not too bad. They got into a lot of really cool detail that I didn't think that they would. And they also do a really good job of describing the fact that it wasn't a button in a briefcase that they pushed. You know, the drills that they show at the beginning of the movie, these definitely take place. Usually the presidents, their incoming presidents, the first thing that they do, kind of the morning of their inauguration, is they go to what's called Blair House. It's across the street from the White House, and they receive their security briefing. And that's where they get tested on and drilled about the procedure to use a nuclear weapon, because in a couple of hours, it's going to be their job now. And they're ultimate responsibility. They're trained on this multiple times through different scenarios, not often at Mount Weather or what probably what in the movie you see them actually getting into a plane, which is a mobile command center. And that is normally where the president would be when they if they have time to launch a nuclear attack. But the procedures you see are pretty great. There's this thing called the biscuit, which is a little plastic card that usually is kept in the kind of the jacket pocket of a president. And it's a little card. You crack it open and it has maybe like 10 or 12 different lines of numbers on them. One of them is the correct one. The rest of them are false. And the president needs to memorize which one is the right one. And it's called the biscuit. President would then, when they want to launch a nuclear attack, they will open up. If they're at the White House, they go to the Situation Room and they don't need the nuclear football. If they're on the mobile command center in the air, they actually don't need the nuclear football because they have people that can make these calls for them. Because all the nuclear football is, which is a briefcase, you see it always carried by a military attaché behind the president. It's with the president at all times. Also one with the vice president as well as the Secretary of State. The Secretary of Defense. All that is really a fancy phone that can reach anywhere around the world. There's some other cool stuff that's inside of it, but you see them using that in the movie. It can communicate with the National Command Authority, which is usually at the Pentagon or at NORAD or, you know, at Omaha. And this, they say, I'm the president. How do I know you're the president? Here, I've got this code that says I'm the president. That's it. The president is then authenticated. Then they say, I want to do this plan. When they read it out of a book, there's some advisors that tell them which one they want to do. Then once that order is given, and they only are usually given about 4 minutes to 5 minutes, because when a missile's in the air, you have 30 minutes before it lands, but it takes like 10 minutes to notice that it's coming. And then you only have a couple of minutes to make your decision, because once they give that order, it takes about 1 minute from the president making a decision and saying, go ahead, for it to go to the National Command Authority, it to be authenticated and then sent down to whether it's the people in a launch silo and giving them the order, they call, you know, emergency action orders, or people that are at bombers and bases, you know, telling them to launch, or orders of submarine to surface and to launch. That order usually takes about 1 minute before the missiles that are in the silos to get in the air. It takes a little bit longer for the submarines to surface, depending on what the plan is. So it's really quick. The one thing I just wanted to note that the book gets wrong a little bit here is that there's a scene at the very end of the book where Ryan, as like director of something, as CIA or whatever, I forget who he's trying to convince, but they talk about this thing called the two-man rule, which is in a lot of nuclear movies. You think about the two-man rule that in a silo where you have to turn two keys that one person couldn't reach. That's definitely a thing that's in silos these days. But there is no similar two-man authentication or two-person authentication when it comes to the president launching an order. The Secretary of Defense is supposed to be there to authenticate the president, and that's who they are as part of the process, but they're not needed. They can't veto a launch unless we do something different. If the procedures do not allow it. And in the movie, I think the defense secretary is convinced that the president is out of his mind and it doesn't go forward with the launch. But that is not that's not a thing in real life. One person, we elect them. That's usually the check, is the individual who has the ability to launch. Otherwise, I think the movie does a pretty good job. It even does a pretty good job of like the visual effects of the nuclear bomb when we do see it detonated in Baltimore. I can get into that detail, but I know we're running out of time here. But if you want to hear about 30 minutes on that, listen to my episode, because we get into it and we use a tool called Nuke Map, which if you ever want to have a fun evening drinking some port or something at home, you can go to nukemap.com and plug in an aim point and a type of a bomb and see what happens.
I have used Nuke Map myself after learning of its existence on your show, and yeah, it's if you had a bad experience in a city, you can fantasize about taking revenge on it. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the exploding helicopter action.
On the Simplistic Reviews podcast, we talk movies. We talk TV. We talk.
Hello, Julie, what the heck are you doing?
Trying to make our spot sound more exciting by adding explosions.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could have got the point across with sound effects, not the real thing.
Download the show on iTunes or at simplisticreviews.blogspot.com.
I'm sure your insurance company will cover that.
No, they won't.
No, they probably won't.
We're back, and now we're talking about the exploding helicopter action. This occurs towards the end of the film. Tensions between the two superpowers have boiled over after Russia attacks an American aircraft carrier. In response, the US president orders a Russian airfield to be bombed, and so we see some F-16 fighter jets launch a series of missiles. We cut back to the American command center, where we see some satellite imagery of the airstrike, and we see a number of different aircraft being blown up. These are sort of aircraft that are on the ground in this airfield, and one of them is a helicopter. So Tim, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I will be a little rude here. I will push back a little bit. So it is another one of my pet peeves. You found it. You got that. You tapped that cavity on my tooth. So it's not satellite imagery, because satellite imagery so rarely is ever seen to be like real time. It's really hard to do satellite imagery because you're passing over something very quickly. You can't just pull up and say, where's the satellite on this right now? It's more like, please, sir, when your satellite is over this thing and if there doesn't have to be cloud cover, can I see an image, please? What we see with this is really interesting, though. As you mentioned, you know, with it being an F-16, right? It's this thing called FLIR, which is called, it's called forward-looking infrared. And it's a little bit of it's a pod. It kind of looks like a missile or a gas tank little thing on the bottom of your airplane. And it takes that infrared image and it looks the difference between a cool image and a hot image. That can be live. That can actually be, you know, sent in fairly okay, you know, quality to the command post or back to the situation room. Or I think in the movie, maybe they're up in the air at the EOC. I think that's what it is. But it does, if you don't know what you're looking for, and it's really quick images stuff, it looks like satellite imagery and things. But I remember this stuff because I wasn't working in this field during the Gulf War, but they were very, very famous imagery. That's when it kind of started to become, you know, on CNN all the time. You would see FLIR images. And I think this was a laser-guided bomb, if I can recall. And FLIR and laser-guided, you combine those things together with either an F-16. I think they also did a lot of helicopters had that. A lot of the helicopters, I think it was Apache and others that were there during the Gulf War. And also F-117s, which are the Nighthawk, which also had the ability to drop a B-61 nuclear bomb. All of those used laser-guided bombs for accuracy, and we'd see a lot of those images. I thought it was cool. It's very quick. You know, it's real fast. I tried so hard over the last week to find out what that helicopter was, where that imagery came from. I watched probably like 2 hours of FLIR footage trying to find it, and I just couldn't find the right thing. But if you Google, you know, FLIR Gulf War footage, you can actually find the first shots fired during the Gulf War, where I think Apache helicopter is destroying like some radar, and it's you know, striking to know kind of where that kind of started our post Cold War situation that we're still kind of living in today. But it's pretty cool. It's very fascinating. You were telling me that in all the movies you've seen, you've never seen anything kind of like that. So it's pretty cool.
No.
It's pretty cool to see. What did you think about it? How does it wrap up?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really caught me by surprise when I stumbled across this on a rewatch of this on this film. And I've not heard of there being a helicopter in it and exploding in it, and in some ways it's kind of an easy one to miss, because as you say, it's not on screen for very long. It's just sort of parked there. It's in this sort of grainy black and white image that we see. And yeah, it is for my money, a completely unique exploding helicopter that we get in this film. I can't recall another helicopter being blown up in this way. So I enjoyed it and appreciated it for being unique. In the grand scheme of things, there aren't really any great stakes to this helicopter being blown up. Like, it wouldn't make a difference to the outcome of this movie whether this helicopter exploded or not. You know, neither the hero and villain are on it or anything like that. So in some ways, it's quite sort of a low stakes exploding helicopter. But from the perspective of seeing something new and different, which I always appreciate from my exploding helicopters, mm-hmm. The Son of All Fears, delivers on that. And so, yeah, for that reason, I kind of perhaps steer people towards if they want to see all the different varieties and flavors of exploding helicopters.
And I would say if someone really, you know, had a threshold, a limit threshold of how many helicopters need to be destroyed in a movie for them to actually, you know, pick up the remote control. Don't worry, even though this is like a 1 second image, there are two other helicopters that get destroyed, and the other two, one of them is carrying Jack Ryan, the other is carrying the U.S. president, and they both get, you know, crashed and destroyed. And I would say some pretty gruesome, but really interesting for 2002, you know, special effects. Not bad for seeing those helicopters, but you're right, they don't explode. They do crash. Most people are generally okay, except for the CIA director when they do land. But if you want your feel, you're going to get enough of those coming down here.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Tim, thank you so much for joining me. Do you want to take a moment to tell people, you know, where they can find you online, where they can listen to your podcast?
Absolutely. We're on every place you find podcasts. It's called the Super Critical Podcast, three words there. It's a little pun for, because we get super critical about the content, but also talk about things what happens when they go super critical. But I'm also on Twitter at Nuclear Podcast. You can email me at supercriticalpodcast@gmail.com if you've got ideas and when you want to cover. But you can see the full list of episodes, notes about our various what we've covered research wise for each episode, as well as some of our interesting guests that we'll have on there. Hopefully at some point in the future I can get you on to chat about something, but it's at supercriticalpodcast.com.
Excellent. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews of films where helicopters explode. If you could rate, review, or retweet, that would be fantastic for us. You know, help us get the word out there. We'd be very grateful. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
What's the t-shirt say?
I'm a bomb technician. If you see me running, try to catch up.